From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, recruitment efforts for a critical part of our democracy, workers at election polling sites.
We're really trying to focus our recruitment efforts on younger people. You can be a poll worker and be 16 or 17 years old. So that's kind of a unique opportunity for maybe high school students or college students.
Then some weird history, bounties on animal species in Michigan.
And so you see individuals have essentially conflicts with various different animals and birds.
And our latest episode of On Hand answers a critical Michigan summer question. Is Superman ice cream really from here?
It says, try the new Superman brick ice cream. It's a three-color brick that checks out.
Yep.
This doesn't. With whole nut meats.
All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, a popular but mysterious summer dip that's been enchanting Michigan kids for generations, Superman ice cream.
So if you had to describe what that tastes like to somebody, what would you say?
Vanilla ice cream.
What, vanilla? Just vanilla?
Vanilla with extra sugar.
With extra sugar. Sweeter vanilla.
But is it really a Michigan-specific thing? We're finding out later this hour. First, though, do you have any plans for November 3rd? Beyond the obvious, I mean. If you do vote in person, you may have seen that many of our polling places across Michigan can be a little shorthanded. It takes several thousand people to run smooth operations for all the clerks in all of our cities, townships, and counties. There really never are enough people to fully staff polls. But this is a paid position, and you should know that clerks are now hiring. The Michigan Chamber Foundation is funding an effort to recruit more help. It's called Support MI Clerks. Dan Papineau is a senior director of strategic initiatives at the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and he's with us now. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Stateside.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Have you ever worked the polls on Election Day?
Oh, my gosh. I must be honest and say that I have not.
I confess, I've always been kind of busy on election days myself, usually covering stories and planning our post-election coverage. But I guess there are all kinds of reasons why people don't step up to work poll jobs. How did you become aware, Dan, that we have this staffing problem?
Yeah, there's a couple family foundations in Michigan that identified the problem. And the Michigan Chamber stepped up as a potential partner to offer some solutions and try to highlight the fact that we have a poll worker shortage and we need to address it. And we thought maybe channeling our network of businesses across the state would be a unique way to bring attention to the matter and a different kind of maybe out-of-the-box thinking to recruit poll workers.
People may be aware from the name that the Michigan Chamber Foundation is an offshoot of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Why is this issue of interest or important to you and the folks that you work with?
So, you know, recruiting poll workers and making sure that we have a smooth election process should really be important to everybody. And it's important to the business community. I think there's a lot of noise around elections and election integrity and, you know, a lot of finger pointing and, you know, stories we hear. So it's just going to have to be a collective effort by all to recruit poll workers, make sure that people understand the security and sanctity of elections are strong and promote poll workers, poll worker recruitment as much as we can.
Who traditionally has done the work of polling places? I have to say, I'm a little ashamed to say, I thought that these were volunteer positions, but they're actually paid?
That's correct. You can make between $175 and $300 a day, depending where you're at and how many days you work. It is actually a paid position. And most poll workers, the data shows, are over the age of 65. So a vast majority, I think it's something like actually 65% are over the age of 65. So we're really trying to focus our recruitment efforts on younger people. You can be a poll worker and be 16 or 17 years old. So that's kind of a unique opportunity for maybe high school students or college students. But really trying to make sure that we kind of build that that network of poll workers. You know, it's very common for a poll worker to volunteer and then continue to volunteer in elections in the future. So as we're struggling to recruit poll workers in general, and the poll worker community is aging, so we need to replace those poll workers that finally hang up their hat and call it a day after serving for many years, and replace them with some younger folks that are interested in the process as well.
Does it take very much to qualify for training?
It is not. So the process is super simple. So there are some eligibility requirements. First, you must not have a felony or election crime conviction. You must not be affiliated with any candidate that's on the ballot. You do have to be registered to vote, unless you're 16 or 17, because a lot of people don't know that 16 and 17-year-olds can volunteer to work the polls. You have to disclose your party affiliation so that we could try to provide as much balance at each polling location as possible. And then you have to be able to perform general tasks, so sitting or standing for a long time, maybe lifting a few boxes here and there, work long hours. But those are the eligibility requirements. And if you meet those and you're interested in becoming a poll worker, you go online, you fill out an application. That application goes to your clerk. The clerk will get in touch with you and schedule a training. So to your question about the training, it's about 1 or 2 hours. It's really not very heavy. It's just kind of getting you familiar with the electoral process and the equipment used. And then after you complete training, you'll get assigned a poll and a time to show up and work. And you can either, more than likely, you're going to be working on election day, but because of early voting, you may be working those 9 days before election day as well. So once you get your day and your time, you show up and get to work.
So beyond the hour or so that you mentioned for training and the option of staffing some of the early voting, is there a time commitment that goes beyond election day itself?
Nope. So once election day comes to a close, your duty comes to a close as well. So the days, though, so it is very flexible. So I do want to say, you know, if you have other obligations, you can try to work with your clerk to either work the early voting days or election day or both. Maybe you got certain hours you're restricted from working because election day is going to be a long day. You're probably going to get there about 6 a.m. and work until 10 p.m. So the time commitment can be pretty heavy, but your clerk should be just grateful you're willing to volunteer and work with you on scheduling.
Dan, I have to ask, we've all seen the videos from some elections past of people showing up at polling places sometimes, challenging staff on what they think is or is not happening at the polls. What is the case for people opting in for this job? Why would you show up at places when we know that there is, you know, there's some vitriol out there amongst people who have unfounded claims about what's happening at polling and with ballot counting?
Yes. Yep. Good question. And that concern does come up. You'll get a little bit of training on that situation with your clerk. But at the end of the day, it's really the clerk and the professional staff's responsibility to handle those types of occurrences. You as a poll worker are committing to making sure that the lines are running smoothly, there's no confusion. You're there to make sure that that experience is positive for folks. And if someone wants to come in and try to be disruptive, then your local clerk and professional staff will know how to handle that. And they'll be very responsive to taking care of any type of situation like that.
Do you have a target goal for your recruiting this year?
I don't think we can have enough poll workers, to be honest. When we talk to local clerks, they about just over half, so about 51% of them say that they do not have enough poll workers. So we need to recruit as many poll workers as possible. I know, like, even here in Ingham County, there was 475 spots, only 350 people to fill them. So the need for poll workers is high, and I don't think we'd ever have enough poll workers. And hey, if we ever get to that problem, then I'd feel very good about our efforts in recruiting poll workers.
One of the things I wondered is whether it's possible to work where the need is greatest. Like if I were to volunteer, do I necessarily have to volunteer within my county or within my own precinct? Or would it be possible for people who opt in to, you know, go where the deficits are the biggest?
Yeah. Great question. And I do get asked that every now and then. Because, yes, you know, people might not want to travel, but maybe they do want to travel. Maybe they want to go where the need is greatest. So more than likely, from my understanding, when I talked to the 1,240 city and township clerks across the state. From my understanding, more than likely, you will probably be in your precinct just because the need is so high that it's very common to be in your own precinct. Now, you might be in your own city or township as well, but chances are that you're going to be within your community, which is pretty cool because you'll see your friends and your neighbors, maybe your family. But the clerk system is strong, and if there's a need somewhere else, they will work together to make sure that they staff the polls appropriately. You know, the Ingham County clerk might coordinate with neighboring counties to fill gaps where necessary. But what I hear most commonly from clerks is that you end up actually being in your own precinct just because the demand is so high.
So you've made this commitment to try to help out with the recruiting on behalf of all of Michigan's clerks. I mean, what does that mean? Can you tell us about how you're spending money and energy to recruit?
Yes, yes. Thank you for asking. So we are doing a digital advertising campaign. So hopefully you'll see some social media posts about the Support MI Clerks initiative and get information through your social media pages. And that's a big piece of it. But we're also offering presentations to local community groups. So if you go to the supportmiclerks.com website and you scroll down to the bottom, there is an option to request a presentation. And if you're a local Rotary Club or a local Chamber of Commerce, really anybody and everybody that's interested, you go down and you fill out that form, and then we'll get in touch with you and we'll show up with a 15-minute presentation on what a poll worker is, why they're important, how to become one. And that way, that helps us get other groups to start spreading the message about the importance of poll worker recruitment. I'd really like to point out the offer for the presentations. And if you're involved with any kind of community or civic group, please look into that and help us spread the word.
Dan, I'm sorry to say I have some work-related commitments of my own here at Michigan Public on Election Day. But if folks are listening right now and they're sold on it, they're ready to help out, where should they go for more information?
Yes. So as mentioned, the supportmiclerks.com website has information, but you can also go directly to the Secretary of State's website, and that is michigan.gov/democracymvp. Either website will get you to the application, and that's the most important piece. Fill out that application, and that really starts the process.
Dan Papineau with the Michigan Chamber Foundation. Dan, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to pause for just a moment here. After that, why Michigan has, at times, put a price on the head of certain animals.
Individuals would have to bring the bounty to the county or local office. They would typically receive a certificate stating the amount the individual brought in and the amount they were entitled to.
We'll hear the history in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's population of hunters is on the wane. For about 10 years now, the Department of Natural Resources has observed very little change in the number of people who are applying to hunt legal game. And yes, there are some rules about what animals hunters can pursue in Michigan. These days, a lot of what's legal to hunt has to do with abundant populations, such as deer. But there have been times when the state of Michigan was targeting very specific animals. And the logic behind what was getting hunted has been somewhat variable. Jason Schultz has been looking into this for us. He's an archivist with the Archive of Michigan and checks in sometimes to share his research. Hey, Jason.
Hey, April.
Why does the bounty system even begin in Michigan's history? Were you able to find like the first one and why it came into being?
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it with that open. A lot of it starts with this perception of good versus bad. And what I mean is, you know, as Michigan gets its statehood and is, you know, settling in more areas across the state, you begin to develop, you know, these higher concentration of cities and villages, and more farms are starting to take root. And so you see individuals have essentially conflicts with various different animals and birds. You know, you may have farms dealing with wolves and coyotes. You might have cities dealing with certain types of birds like pigeons. And they started to realize that they couldn't really coexist with one another. You know, if we're talking about farms, wolves and coyotes may, you know, prey on their livestock, or crows may eat their crops. And if we're talking about cities, pigeons may, you know, do their business on the streets, and they were concerned about health effects on individuals. So you start to see this sort of blend between, you know, humans living with animals and animals living with humans.
So these were things that weren't just encouraged in certain parts of the state. These bounties were enacted by law. I guess I kind of get it in some ways. A bounty on rats, you know, kind of makes sense since they absolutely do definitely carry diseases. But it seems like some of the larger species like wolves might have been a little bit more controversial. Were the motions for bounties on animals ever divisive in terms of state politics?
Yeah, I think like anything, you know, these sorts of issues eventually become political. You know, if we're talking specifically about hunters, you know, particularly with like sportsmen, there was a concern that, you know, the deer populations would dwindle if we had too many wolves or coyotes. And if you have these new farms popping up throughout the state, agriculturists saw as, you know, certain lands not being utilized because of the threat, again, of, you know, certain predators. And you also just have, you know, fishermen who are concerned about, you know, certain types of sports fish being, you know, attacked by raptors. And so hunters, herdsmen, they really start pressuring the state government to find ways to eliminate certain populations.
Do you have any sense of how much of a role science had to play in some of these bounties? I hear you that hunters had their concerns and farmers and ranchers had their concerns, but was there a lot of data back in the day when some of these were being enacted?
No, and I think that's the unfortunate consequence of all of this in many ways, is that there wasn't any sort of guidance. I mean, if you look on the other side of the debate, you know, the political debate, there are a lot of conservation and Audubon societies very concerned about this this motivation to get rid of so many different types of animals and birds. And you certainly had wildlife authorities trying to push for, you know, at bare minimum, at least less bounties on animals, but hopefully the elimination, because, you know, there's obviously negative consequences when you disrupt an ecosystem, because if you're killing a bunch of wolves, then, you know, what happens to the deer population? It probably balloons and starts to dominate.
Right. How many animal bounties do we have throughout Michigan's history?
So this is a bit of an estimate, but I think it gives a good sense of how many, you know, there had been throughout, you know, the late 19th and early 20th centuries. For birds, there was around 16 different bounties at one point or another. And for mammals, there was around 10.
It's kind of wild to think about state tax dollars going toward paying for the killing of animals. How were the bounties paid out?
So they were typically paid by the counties or local governments. Individuals would have to bring the bounty to the county or local office. They would typically receive a certificate from, say, the township clerk stating the amount the individual brought in and the amount they were entitled to. So payments actually weren't immediate. They would, the actual cash would come later, but you would see certain individuals would provide cash up front if they brought the bounties to the private individual, and they would take it to the county to get the cash later.
Wow. So like brokers of bounties.
Essentially,
so
yeah.
That's crazy. Are there any bounties in Michigan law right now?
There are none at the state level, but it's important to note a lot of these bounties were actually fairly recent. The rat bounty was only repealed in 2000, and the bounty on crows was only repealed in 2006. And we still consider certain animals to be a quote-unquote nuisance. Animals like squirrels, skunks, small rodents, they still can be removed by private individuals off your property, but the government will not pay for their removal.
I'm thinking about what you said about some people offering to handle the bounty for someone who would bring in an animal. Who would you say capitalized on the bounty system the most?
Well, mostly hunters and trappers, certainly farmers and sportsmen. I mean, you certainly see individuals who have a lot of direct contact with the certain types of animals. The state did at one point hire or create a sort of professional group to go out and tackle these troublesome animals. They paid them a salary, but that wasn't exactly effective because they were kind of getting paid for whether they achieved their goal or not. And so, you know, it also really depended on the species. So obviously hunters are probably going to be more inclined to go, you know, take on wolves and coyotes, but maybe, you know, everyday individuals, farmers, they may feel more comfortable taking on rats or crows or, you know, whatever.
Mm. I could see times in history when the bounties would have been maybe something of a blessing, maybe like during the Great Depression. Are there times in Michigan history when we see more bounties cashed in?
Yeah, you certainly see it pretty prominent during times of economic hardship, like you said, during the Great Depression. Because you have to imagine if the government is offering money to in exchange for an animal, there are a lot of people who could use that as an opportunity to make money. And so, you know, during the Great Depression, you see a lot of the public, even kids, for the first time making a good amount of money. Because if the state is going to offer you 10 cents for a rat or 50 cents for a crow, and, you know, you live in a farm or a high density area and you bring, say, 30 to 40 of these, I mean, that's a lot of money. But we do tend to see that, you know, if the economy is doing well or if it's improving, there is a little less inclination to cash in on the bounties. That's not to say that people aren't doing it, but, you know, the individuals who are capitalizing on it is a lot less.
I just realized that I kind of assumed that this was a rural thing that happened. Is that true, or were there ever bounties closer to where you saw big concentrations of Michiganders living?
Oh, it was all over the state. I mean, you had individuals in Detroit, you know, tackling rat problems, tackling pigeon problems. So it was not specifically a rural issue. I mean, certainly there are probably more variety of bounties in more rural areas, but there were all the public in all the different areas, you know, found the opportunity in doing this.
Okay, Jason, it's kind of wild to think about people sports shooting in the city of Detroit.
Well, it's kind of dangerous too. It's one of the consequences of doing this. I mean, if you think of Detroit, there's obviously going to be a probably pretty large rat population, a pretty large bird population, and so there are instances of individuals in Detroit poisoning bait and having certain birds, you know, eat the bait and unfortunately die, and then they turn in the bounty.
Oh man, does it seem like bounties generally were an effective method in terms of, I mean, I don't know, there were lots of different reasons that you've explained to us about why they were posted, but like in terms of public health, can we say that this had some positive impact?
I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that a lot of these weren't entirely effective. And because of that, there was just a lot of issues that came up when it came to these certain bounties. I mean, there was fraud for basically every sort of animal that was turned in. You had, you know, certain animals dying who weren't considered a bounty. I mean, we have talked about birds who had bounties, but there are certain songbirds and favorable birds who did not have a bounty. And if individuals are poisoning bait and these songbirds eat it, I mean, they're just sort of collateral damage to the bounty. And the state spent a fair amount of money on these programs. I mean, when it came to mammals only, over the course of its time between about 1934 and 1979, the state spent over $5 million.
Oh my gosh.
Paying individuals. And, you know, you in some instances see the population of animals not be fazed by it at all. Or in some cases, you see the population of animals like wolves be fazed or impacted a lot. So much so that they were on the endangered species list at one point. So it's really hard to see how this was an effective way to deal with the problem Michigan was facing.
Wait a minute. You said something a minute ago about fraud in terms of bounties. I mean, how does that work? Like people trying to pass off some poor dog as a coyote?
Yeah, you have instances of those. You have instances where individuals from out of state, such as Wisconsin or even Canada, bringing in wolf pelts to Michigan to be sold. And there were certain instances where if a wolf or a coyote is hit with a car, you could turn that into as a bounty. And you have to remember that when individuals bring these bounties to the county office or the township clerk, they usually bring it in a box or a sack, and it's just, you know, rotting carcasses. And, you know, how many clerks want to open it up and count to make sure you have, you know, 10, 20, 30 of those in there? So a lot of individuals would lie about the number, or would, you know, say they have 10 rats when they're actually mice. So it was not an exactly effective way of doing things.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fact that there was some species die-off. Anything else that you've observed in the historic record about unintended effects of all this?
Yeah, wolves is an obvious one. I think one that really caught my eye was robins. While robins never had a bounty themselves, there was a good amount of people in Michigan who didn't like them because they were fruit birds and they would eat cherry crops or other fruit crops. And so there was a push to put a bounty or eliminate the robin, which is strange seeing as that is our state bird.
So in
terms of, you know, the populations themselves, it's hard to pinpoint something as comparable as the wolf, but the attitude towards certain species compared then to now is quite perplexing.
Jason, do you think any of the bounties of the past would really surprise people today?
Yes. You know, we've talked about wolves and coyotes. There were bounties at one point on dogs, and there were bounties on certain felines.
You are kidding me.
Particularly bobcats and lynx, but there was at one point a bounty for cats. And the reason for that was there was a concern about songbirds again, the sort of stray and feral cats attacking certain songbirds. And, you know, there's a story of at least at one point at a farm near Mason that 18 cats were killed during the years of 1917 and 1918. So it wasn't just wild animals that had these bounties.
This is just so confusing. On the one hand, bounties, you know, leading people to kill some birds, and also bounties to kill dogs and cats. I mean, Was it just shoot first and ask questions later for much of Michigan history?
Well, the more surprising thing is that there was basically a bounty on cats, or at least the you know, maybe not a bounty, but, you know, people were allowed to kill cats until 1978. So we, you know, a lot of these bounties we've been talking about in the distant past, but a lot of these things were relatively recent.
This is all really kind of sad in a way. Have you found any evidence of maybe state law trying to counteract some of the unintended consequences that bounties set into motion?
Yeah, what I find very ironic, in 1913, the Michigan legislature passed Public Act number 227, and it was basically an act to sort of establish public education in the state. But there's one part that I found particularly interesting. And it stated that an act to provide a system of humane education which shall include kind treatment to domestic and wild animals and birds for the purpose of lessening crime and raising the standards of good citizenship and inculcating the spirit of humanity. Mm. That was in 1913, and a lot of these bounties are, you know, happening in the late 1800s and into the 1970s. And so I think it's interesting that the state government is, you know, trying to inspire, you know, children to have a good respect for animals, but at the same time we're having this bounties. And you know, maybe they didn't realize it then, but it seems like, you know, today communities are certainly learning to live with the wildlife and let nature regulate itself. And, you know, and I certainly think we have a better appreciation for wildlife than maybe we did back then.
Jason Schultz with the Archives of Michigan. Jason, thank you so much for this.
Thanks, April.
We're about about to get into the latest episode of On Hand, and we just want you to know, we're hoping to hear from you. What questions do you have about our state? Are there conversations or encounters that you've had this summer that got you wondering about something uniquely Michigan? Maybe you went to a Tigers game and started thinking about the construction of Comerica Park. Or maybe you're preparing to walk across the Mackinac Bridge on Labor Day and want to know if it's actually possible to climb up to the top. Or perhaps you have a Michigan food history question about shawarma or Asian corned beef egg rolls or the Boston Cooler. What's been on your mind lately about Michigan? Our podcast, On Hand, is designed specifically to investigate your questions about this quirky and wonderful place where we live. And we're ready to get you some answers. Send them to us by email, onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or you can fill out the form at the Michigan Public website. Just look for the On Hand page. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we settle a listener's question about Superman ice cream. Is it the Michigan original that we think it is?
I have the ad here. It says, try the new Superman brick ice cream. It's a three-color brick. That checks out.
Yep.
This doesn't. With whole nut meats.
Oh, this job is such a beast. But, you know, somebody's got to do it. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Stateside.
Yeah, I'm Nicole Vargas. I live in Saline, Michigan. I've always been curious if Superman ice cream actually originated here in Michigan. Well, it's really fun, obviously, because of the color, but are there Superman connections in Michigan? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it. So it seems like a weird choice for Michigan, but I like it.
This year, Food & Wine magazine named Superman ice cream the most Michigan-y ice cream. The most Michigan-y. Blue like the Great Lakes. Red like a sunset in South Haven. Yellow like, I don't know, Detroit streetlights glowing after dark, whatever. You get where I'm going here. It's Michigan. Michigan made in scoopable form. But how old is this seemingly timeless treasure of Superman ice cream? Who made it first? And as Nicole asks, is it indeed from Michigan? Is it really the most Michigan-y Michigan ice cream flavor of all time? We're getting the scoop for you today. This is On Hand, a podcast about all the things that make Michigan unique. I'm April Bear.
It's a bird!
It's a plane!
It's Superman! Yes, it's Superman!
Digging into this story for us is executive producer and ice cream enthusiast Laura Weber-Davis. Laura, hello.
Hey, April.
Let's set the table here. What is the flavor of this tricolored treat?
So the blue color is Blue Moon. I mean, nobody disputes that. But people do dispute what the flavor of Blue Moon is. We can get into that if you want to. But red is either Red Pop, like Faygo Red Pop, or cherry.
Spot on.
And then the yellow flavor is lemon or vanilla. But it all kind of comes out in an amalgamation that is similar. It is fruity, it's tart, it's smooth, it's childlike. And it kind of tastes like, for me, it tastes like almost like the milk from Fruit Loops. You know what I mean? At the end?
Wow.
And maybe it's just the colors that make me feel that way, but it tastes distinctly like childhood.
Yeah, for me, it's joy. It's pure joy. I get the cotton candy forward a lot depending on, you know, who made the Superman ice cream brand that I'm eating, but I don't know. It's just...
Yeah, what do you taste?
It's that. It's the tartness, but I don't know. There's something about it that is sort of borders on sorbet flavors. I love it, personally.
Yeah, but not sorbet texture.
Right.
It's decidedly ice cream. It's creamy.
There's something about the name of it, though. I really think that's something to do with the popularity. Superman!
Yeah, you know, when the ice cream really becomes, when we see it accelerate in popularity, is in the early to mid 80s is when it really started to be advertised in newspapers. And if you remember,
it's really the time when the Christopher Reeves movies were taking off.
Superman, help us!
Is there no one on this planet to even challenge me?
Superman, Big One's just as strong as Superman.
General, would you care to step outside?
The adventure continues in Superman 2.
And these movies were...
just wildly successful.
Exactly. It was a cultural phenomenon.
So is that when the popularity of Superman ice cream really kind of had its wave, was the 1980s?
Not if you ask the internet. I just Googled it before I walked in here, and this is the thing that drives me crazy. If you ask the internet, it is an old-timey flavor, and it comes from the Prohibition era.
Did you know that Superman ice cream comes from the home of one of Michigan's biggest passions, a brewery?
But according to legend, the first time a Superman-style ice cream was ever distributed was during Prohibition.
Between 1920 and 1933 by the Stroh Brewery Company.
In 1933, the owner converted the beer brewing facility to produce non-alcoholic products, including the first red, yellow, and blue Superman ice cream.
End of story.
Wow. I mean, that kind of hits.
It sounds great. But there are two problems with that. One, Superman the comic came out after Stroh's started making ice cream. And two, Stroh's ice cream, the company, doesn't take credit for starting Superman ice cream.
Really?
No. Well, at least not to my interactions with them. I have never seen them publicly comment on the beginning of Superman ice cream. And I should note, it's now called Super Rainbow by this company. And when I started working on this story, I emailed them. And here's what she said.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for reaching out. I connected with our brand team, and unfortunately, we don't have anyone with historical information to discuss.
That was it.
Ah, so, right. So we're not sure... actually, if Superman started with Stroh's and Stroh's will not confirm or deny, is there any place else we can take this from here?
The history of it, it's hard. Remember that the question is actually not from Nicole about who started it, but did it start in Michigan? And that's a little easier to get our arms around. If you go into newspaper archives, nearly all of the early advertisements for Superman ice cream are from Michigan ice cream parlors and Michigan-based brands. And one of those early brands, a pioneer you might say, is Hudsonville ice cream from West Michigan.
Hudsonville. Okay, so theirs is the Super Scoop. I've seen that in the grocery store.
That's right. But they still, like most of these brands, were originally calling it Superman. But you can imagine that, you know, they don't have the naming rights to Superman.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that's DC Comics IP.
Yeah, if you go and you look at trademarks... and you type in Superman, it's all coming back to DC. And so I reached out to Hudsonville now to talk about Super Scoop. And they said, sure, yeah, they'd love to talk about Super Scoop.
Still a common name for it is Superman. To be honest, when Hudsonville started making it in about the 1980s, we probably called it that as well. Moving more towards the Super Scoop for probably the same reasons you just brought up. But you'll still see the colors of kind of that DC comic in there with the red, yellow, and blue.
And so I met Lily from Hudsonville.
My name is Lily Cry. I'm HR generalist at Hudsonville Ice Cream.
At a cute little community ice cream shop that you walk up to in Grand Haven. It's called Norm's. Yeah. And they hand dip Hudsonville ice cream, including Super Scoop.
Oh, do you want to? I'm gonna get a Super Scoop, but we're gonna. Can I make it like two scoops, like something bigger?
Yeah, make it kids. It's bright colors. It's fun. It attracts your eye, but it also tastes great. It's actually three flavors in one. So yellow is vanilla, blue is the beloved Blue Moon flavor, and then the red is black cherry. Everybody describes it a little different. Some people feel like they get a like Tutti Frutti Fruit Loop flavor. Some people go a little bit pistachio flavored. It's just kind of whatever your brain thinks it is what you taste.
All right, Zeffy. What do you think about Superman ice cream?
You can't really taste all the flavors.
Individually?
Yeah.
So if you had to describe what that tastes like to somebody, what would you say?
It's like... vanilla ice cream.
What, vanilla? Just vanilla?
Vanilla with extra sugar.
With extra sugar. Sweeter vanilla.
Junie, what do you think? I think it's just the nostalgia of it. growing up in the area, everybody always had Hudsonville ice cream. Started as a dairy co-op in 1926 in Hudsonville, Michigan. Started with just a handful of flavors. And then in 2003, the Ellens family bought the company, moved it to Holland. So that's where we are locally, making all your favorite ice creams in Holland now.
Do you like Super Scoop because you work for Hudsonville, or do you like, I'm going to get Super Scoop?
For me, it's nostalgic. It reminds me of being a kid getting ice cream at the bowling alley down the street from our house. Even like seeing it and like I come, the smell like comes to my mind of the bowling alley and like being there with my family. And I think a lot of people relate to it in that way.
So because it was a flavor that started in the 1980s and was like a really childhood nostalgic thing in the 80s, do you think that we see more adults ordering Super Scoop than maybe you did in the 80s, where people maybe favored butter pecan or something that was a little more traditional?
I think we're all kids at heart, so maybe if your kid orders it, you're going to sneak a few scoops as well, because everybody just still loves it.
It feels like it's ubiquitous when you're here, but it really is like maybe very centrally located in Michigan. Is that true?
As far as I know, yeah, it seems to be a Midwest thing. If you mention it to people kind of outside Michigan or in different states, they're a little bit caught off guard. Like, we don't have that where I'm from. But here, if you hear Super Scoop, Superman, you know exactly what we're talking about.
The most Michigan-y flavor.
Exactly. You might be able to find it in like Ohio or Wisconsin, but it's really a Michigan ice cream all the way.
But did it start here?
April, there was really only one way to pressure test the Krypton Dairy origins of Superman ice cream, and that was with a historian. So if you'll indulge me here, I'm going to head over and talk with the Michigan archivist who just happened to be interested in this question as well. So when I was looking for a historian to help me decipher whether Michigan can lay claim to Superman ice cream, I reached out to the state's official archivist.
I'm Mark Harvey. I'm the state archivist of Michigan.
And he responded, "So funny you ask. I've already been looking into this."
Yeah, I feel like I probably shouldn't admit that, but yes.
The internet will have you believe that Stroh's is where it started, and the logic is something along the lines of, well, Stroh's is a Michigan brand, and in the Depression era, they moved to making ice cream rather than beer, and therefore and subsequently they started Superman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems like the logic, and that's about all the connections I can find. Beyond that, can you find any more evidence?
No. And when you're actually tracking down the sources, you're really left with the internet. And usually those searches typically start at Wikipedia. And so that's where you see what you just described in detail, in words. And I feel like everyone's referencing that Wikipedia article because nowhere else. And really for this sort of topic, there's not going to be lots of archival collections. So we rely on newspapers. And so, as you know, when you do a deep newspaper search, there's nothing.
Right. You and I were both looking at different newspaper collections and archives. And what did we find? What did you find that was interesting about the history of Superman in newspaper clippings?
Well, do you want to work backwards from your original theory?
Yeah.
Okay. Your original theory was that it was really the Superman movie in 1978.
Yeah, and that's when the ice cream came around.
That was your theory.
That's my theory.
Right, and so of course I tried to debunk it. Immediately.
Yes, okay, right.
Well, I mean, it sounded good, and I remember as whatever, 8, 9-year-old getting Superman ice cream at various locations in the East Lansing area. That made sense, but we did some newspaper searching, and it's actually really problematic.
My theory or the newspaper searching?
Well, your theory was problematic because there's definitely mention of it beforehand. Not of Stroh's, but you go back as far as 1941, and we found, I think we've both found the same article.
Yeah.
It's from a newspaper in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And it was for Folo's newsstand selling an ice cream, a brick ice cream. I have the ad here. It says, try the new Superman brick ice cream. It's a three-color brick. That checks out.
Yep.
This doesn't. With whole nut meats. Leave it to Wisconsin to mess up something.
Right, exactly. It didn't say cheese curds, though, so it's a start.
Okay, that's fair.
The 1941 ad threw me off, especially because it's sort of an outlier. Where did you start to see a more prolific advertisement for Superman ice cream?
There was a mention in the Flint Journal, July 3rd of 72, and that ad talks about Superman ice cream being red, yellow, and blue ice cream that quote, tastes like a red sucker. Okay. That's really appealing. So that was the only one until, now this gives your theory some credence, after the Superman movie in the 80s is when you really start to see it explode. And then in the late 90s and 2000s, everybody talking about where it came from.
Right.
Right. And so there was all this mystery. So I don't want to completely invalidate your theory. I think the popularity of it, not surprisingly, took off after the movie.
Yeah.
And also just the 80s were the new Technicolor. Anything that was
absolutely
fluorescent was good.
When people talk about Superman ice cream now, they talk about it with a sense of nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But the sense of nostalgia is that, like, Superman ice cream is a force of nature that has been here forever. But I feel like looking through newspaper clippings with you has shown me that it hasn't really been around forever. It's just been around forever for those of us who are middle-aged adults now. And so therefore, it feels like it must have been something that predated us.
Yeah. I mean, so we could refine it and say we haven't found evidence that it was overwhelming evidence that it was around back to when Wikipedia said it started in the 20s, which or early 30s,
yeah,
which predates Superman itself, right, which that I don't even understand that. So maybe it was the flavor profile called something else that then when the original Superman came out in the 30s, the comic, that they altered the name at that point. We can't prove any of that. So, yeah, I think we, in this maybe is less historian and more sociologist, but like we like to have collective memories. Right? We like to have touchstones, especially good ones. And face it, like the last few generations have had a lot of negative touchstones. And so to have something like Superman ice cream that you like, you either love it or you hate it, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things that we like to own together. So there's maybe a communal aspect of it. And so as much as I want, for whatever silly reason, to be able to say, yep, Michigan owns Superman. I wish we owned Blue Moon too, but I think Wisconsin probably has a better claim to that. There's not really the evidence there to make that claim.
All right, so what are your main takeaways? What can you tell us we know definitively as a historian?
We know that Superman ice cream possibly...
This is already getting bad.
Okay, wait.
Okay.
Let me, we have definite evidence that Superman ice cream was in circulation prior to the 1978 motion picture. We have also contrary evidence that some folks in Wisconsin were serving it in 1941 or something under that name, although they put nuts in it.
We don't even know what three flavors were in that brick ice cream.
We don't.
Yeah.
So we'll just discount the 41.
Yeah.
So we have 72 in Flint.
Yeah, that's not bad.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. I'll take it. So Michigan has a strong claim to Superman ice cream. There's no question. But no single company owns it, and no one can lay claim to it. Superman is an ice cream of the people.
Truth, justice, and the American way.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, April.
So that's Nicole's question. If you have questions about other Michigan signature dishes, send them to us. We have an email account all set up for this. It's onhand@michiganpublic.org. This is April Baer. We'll see you next time. Take care.